The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You are listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 28th of November 2022 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I am Markus Hippi. Coming up on today's programme. Further arrests are made following COVID protests in China's major cities. But is Beijing preparing to put a halt to the demonstrations? Also ahead, France's President Emmanuel Macron is to make just his second official visit to the United States. We'll examine Franco-American relations. Plus the day's business news, and then Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be here to unpack the FIFA World Cup in Qatar.
Hello, Marcus. Today we discuss the football idol Brazil needs and record TV ratings for the World Cup.
All that right here on The Briefing with me, Markus Hippi. Police in Shanghai have been detaining more people following protests against China's strict COVID-19 measures. Demonstrations erupted over the weekend when people gathered in some of China's largest cities, with some calling for President Xi Jinping to resign. Jonathan Cheng, China bureau chief at the Wall Street Journal, told Georgina Godwin why a fire in Urumqi in the Xinjiang region has forced people onto the streets across the country.
Obviously, Xinjiang has been in the news for the last few years, largely because of Beijing's treatment of the Uyghur minority there. But it's not directly related to that per se, but there was a fire in a residential tower there that killed 10 people. And even though the authorities have denied it, most people who have been following that news within China have come to the conclusion that the cause of the deaths was effectively because this building was under lockdown and people were trapped in this building and couldn't escape because of strict COVID rules that remain in place almost 3 years after the initial outbreak.
So tell us what's happened now, particularly over this weekend, because we have seen these shouts for Xi to go, for down with the Communist Party and all the rest of it. It seems to be pretty widespread.
It is, and that's what makes this unusual. I mean, you see occasionally protests in China. Obviously, this is not a country where public demonstrations are encouraged. In fact, quite to the contrary, they're very rapidly suppressed and punished typically. But in this case, what you're seeing is this really rare, I don't know if I'd call it spontaneous. It's certainly not coordinated in the sense that there's no single mastermind here, but I think many people in China, having basically been subjected to these controls now for 3 years, we're about to enter the fourth year of COVID here, have kind of concluded that they've had enough. And, you know, there were a couple of signs that people had seized on to look for some hope that perhaps there was going to be an easing of these measures. And I think with each, you know, little glimmer of hope that came, the Communist Party came out and basically said, no, we're going to stick to this. Persistence is victory. And as we head into the winter, you see cases rising and you see these rules not get any lighter. If anything, it's the same old rules. And I think people they've just had enough. And so, you know, the Urumqi fire was a catalyzing moment. But I think what it really did, of course, was it just sort of was an excuse almost for everyone to stand up and express themselves.
That was Jonathan Cheng speaking to us a bit earlier. Let's unpack this further now with the founder of China Dialogue, Isabel Hilton. Isabel, welcome to the program. Could you first tell us What do you think about the situation? How exceptional are the protests we are seeing across China?
Oh, they're definitely exceptional. I mean, as Jonathan was saying, you do see protests in China. They tend to be over specific local issues against, you know, specific abuses by local government. They're very rarely targeted at the party, at the leadership, at the system, because that is regarded as treason. And that can, you know, that is a career or a life ending move. So the courage of the people who have been driven onto the streets by COVID, but then have, gone beyond COVID to call for political change is quite unusual and fairly remarkable. And it does appear to be fairly widespread, though I would enter the caveat that actually we don't know. We are looking at images that people have captured. They're from all over China. They're fairly extraordinary demonstrations. But what is very hard to gauge is the scale within any given city of those demonstrations, or the longevity. We see these snapshots rather than, you know, a long moment. So it's quite hard to be accurate, but unusual, absolutely.
Do we have an idea to which extent these protests are still about COVID restrictions and to which extent about something else? As has been mentioned already, protesters have been heard calling for the freedom of press, for example, and also for the president to resign.
Yes, and you see, when protests take hold, you tend to get a particular meme. And in this instance, the particular meme is the holding up of a blank sheet of paper, which is obviously a symbol for censorship. And I was watching a video of a young woman in an absolute third-tier city, not anywhere, you know, a third-tier city in Zhejiang in central China, with a tape over her mouth, holding a white sheet of paper, chains on her wrists, walking just very, very calmly down an ordinary street. Now, that's, you know, that's a pretty brave thing to do. She's easily identifiable. She is making a point which is really not about COVID, or goes way beyond COVID. Now, how many people there are, we don't know, but you can be absolutely sure that they will be targeted. The other thing that I did notice is that there's a lot of chant and response going on in the slogans, and some of that chant and response has picked up on what was on a banner that appeared on a bridge in Beijing just before the 20th Party Congress. And it said a whole series of things like we don't want dictators for life. We want elections. We want freedom. We don't want lockdown. We want food. And you can hear these slogans being chanted again all over China. Again, what's the scale? But I think the speed at which it's happened is indicative that there are really a lot of very, very weary, fed up people, and that they blame the government.
Do you think Beijing can control the situation?
Yes, I think they probably can. I think quite how they control the situation is what they're thinking about. But Beijing has ways. Sometimes they are straightforwardly brutal. But in other situations, they try to negotiate a bit, you know, try to do triage, separate out the terminally fed up from the merely irritated today, that kind of thing. So I would expect to see an accelerated vaccination program, for example. I would expect to see a rebuke of abuses by local officials, because the local officials have been over implementing the policy, and it's quite convenient for Beijing to try to deflect the anger back on lower level officials who can then be punished. Takes it away from the central government. The central government can then say, look, we're looking after your interests. They'll pick off the people with an overtly political message, and they will try to reassure the others that they have listened and that they will be on the case. What we're seeing in terms of control is an increasing presence of police, huge numbers of police now on the streets of major cities. We probably see some water cannon get deployed if it needs to be. I think we're quite a long way off anyone being shot. I hope I'm right.
I hope so too. Just finally, Isabel, is it becoming clear that China will have to change its COVID policy?
Yes. I mean, I think it's absolutely a blind alley, but they're a bit stuck. because of the low vaccination rate and the relative ineffectiveness of the Chinese vaccines. But again, you could introduce an mRNA vaccine. There are also some treatments coming online which might help. So what I'm sure they would like to do is be able to open up without a very high death rate, because the low death rate has been a key point of propaganda for the party, showing, look, we care about you, look at these irresponsible democracies, people are dying in enormous numbers. Were that to happen in China, the party would really be discredited. So it's choosing to maintain its credibility in this very, very limited area, beyond taking the risk, if you like, of a pandemic that gets out of control again.
Thank you very much, Isabel. That was the founder of China Dialogue, Isabel Hilton. And now here is Monocle's Tom Edwards with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Reuters reports that the Pentagon is considering a proposal from Boeing to supply Ukraine with small precision bombs that can be attached to rockets. It's thought that the move would allow the Ukrainian military to strike targets far behind Russian lines. There have been several arrests in Brussels following Morocco's victory over Belgium in a World Cup match in Qatar. Dozens of football fans, some of them displaying Moroccan flags, clashed with riot police. Water cannon and tear gas were used to disperse the crowds. And here, the UK government has said it plans to make over £1 billion of public funding available for home insulation projects from early next year. The move's an attempt to widen access to assistance previously only available to lower-income households. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Marcus.
Thank you very much, Tom. The French President Emmanuel Macron will travel to the White House this week for just his second state visit to the United States. It follows a very public spat between Washington and Paris over America's new security pact with the UK and Australia. So what is the purpose of Macron's visit? Philippe Marlier is a professor of French and European politics at University College London, and he joins me in the studio. Welcome to the programme. Philip, it's been over 4 years since Emmanuel Macron last visited the White House, and obviously the United States has got a new president since then, but how different are the relations between France and the US compared to 2018?
Well, as you said, you know, the relations have been of late not so good, not so smooth. You know, they've been, in particular a year ago, this big feud between, on the one hand, the French, and then the UK, the US, and Australia. You know, which torpedoed a major submarine contract. So I think that left really a bad taste in on the French side, in the French's mouth, so to speak. So I think relationship between the US and France are never easy, although they are, of course, allies. And I think this visit is there absolutely to consolidate this relation, to highlight to highlight Franco-US friendship, and also to discuss a lot of economic issues, which are very important, and also the position of France and the US with regards to the war in Ukraine. France has been criticized, Macron himself has been criticized by the US and also by a number of Central Eastern European countries for, keeping in touch with Putin more than it should have at the start of the war, for also not providing enough military aid. So these are, of course, big issues that they have to discuss, and also they have to discuss the sort of the new threat, which is, for the time being, an economic threat coming from China. So a lot of things, but I think essentially they will concentrate on economic issues.
Quite a few things to talk about over here. Before we talk about Ukraine, before we talk about China, let's still look at the relations between France and the US at the moment. I'm wondering how long-term damage did the security pact Washington did with the UK and Australia cause? How much trust is there between Washington and Paris at the moment?
It's very difficult to tell because, of course, in public, they play, of course, the friendship card, and they have to. But I think, yes, it's very clear that a year ago, when this big contract about, the sale of submarines to Australia was ditched at the very last minute, and it turned out that, in fact, the Americans and the British were involved in that. I think, of course, that the French were not happy about it. And there is still probably, as we speak, a sort of slight distrust on the part of France. But I think of late, what have been really on top of the agenda is really close ties, a need to sort of have a united front against the Russian threat, against Putin, aid to Ukraine. And I think, again, on that, probably there are some differences that will be sort of the need to iron them out. But I think this is essentially probably a thing of the past. I think there's a new thing, in fact, which is, again, an economic issue. The so-called U.S. Inflation Reduction Act, with the acronym, strange acronym of IRA. I think it's essentially a massive subsidy package which Biden is giving to his American business and utilities. And of course, France is unhappy about it because he sees that as unfair competition. You know, it is not allowed in EU law to subsidize national firms. So it makes it much more difficult for French and European firms in general to penetrate the American market. So he will sort of plead on behalf of his European partners and also on behalf of France to get exemptions to that, similar to the ones which Mexico and Canada received lately, which is, for instance, it's not simply France. The German car industry is very much hit by it. Much more difficult to sell cars in the very protected US market now.
If we look at the situation in Ukraine, I'm wondering how much closer has that war in Ukraine brought Paris and Washington to each other? And you also mentioned that there are some differences, even though these countries are pretty united as a front with other Western nations. What are those small things that need to be ironed out?
Well, when it comes to geopolitics, never easy between the US and France, as I said earlier. And I think France, you know, since Charles de Gaulle, has a sort of ambition, probably punching above its belt, to be a playmaker in world affairs. So that was, in a sense, what Macron tried to do at until the very first moments of the war by being on the phone with Putin. And I was very much, he was criticized for that because at some point it was clear that his approach was counterproductive. So I think now we can say that France and Macron are clearly on the side of, you know, all the democracies in the West, notably, which fight Putin and sees Putin as a major threat to world peace. However, there are still differences because you can, here and there, Macron can make a speech saying, well, let's not humiliate Putin and Russia. Another time he was in Rome a few days or weeks ago saying that probably time has come to negotiate and time for peace has come. These are not the things that Biden would be quite ready to say yet, at least publicly. And also one has to take into account the sort of French elites, media, politics, left and right, the people working in foreign affairs, which traditionally have always been wary of being too aligned, too closely aligned with the US. You know, again, France playing a different card, a bit being autonomous. But of course, there are also critiques, and starting with, you know, critics in France saying, well, that's all very well to be autonomous, but, you know, the days of Charles de Gaulle are over. Now France doesn't have the means to dictate what is to be done. For instance, the military aid has been quite modest on the part of France, you know, they, because of the military budgets have been quite depleted the past years.
You mentioned China already earlier. In which role will that country be discussed, and what are the issues Macron and Biden are going to tackle?
I think regarding China, I think the French position would be, again, to sort of to acknowledge, of course, like the US, that China has now become a sort of, of course, it's been a major power and also economically a power which could be become a threat to European and American economies. But again, when you listen to Macron carefully, you realize that probably he wouldn't want to be too jugular with China as opposed to America, which has been more critical lately. So, again, an attempt to be in between major powers, an attempt to sort of be in a role of negotiator, whether France has the means to achieve that, it remains to be seen.
It's going to be a busy visit. Just finally, Philippe, I'm wondering what are the things stopping Macron's priority list at the moment? What is it that he would like to take home from Washington?
I think he's very much interested in a deal on energy, notably nuclear power energy. You know, France has a large nuclear plant, which is getting old and needs to be fixed. And I think he's very much in touch with experts on the US style to come to France to repair some of the plants and also to develop new ones. And France has always been pushing hard traditionally for more nuclear energy and development of nuclear plants. And I think on that would be, I think, a very important topic of discussion with President Biden.
It's going to be interesting to see if that's going to work out in Washington, D.C. Philippe Marlier, thank you very much for joining us today. It is 12:20 here in London. You are with The Briefing.
The Foreign Desk is Monocle 24's weekly global affairs program. We tackle the world's biggest news stories, as well as those left untold.
If actually you speak to the ordinary people, their aspirations is for a unified country, whether you talk to business people, to school teachers, to market traders, and so on and so forth, across the board, is they want to see their country recreated as it was, only this time as a democratic, accountable system.
Our expert guests offer in-depth analysis and first-hand experience.
One of the Ebola treatment centres I went to had been burned down by a community that were very resentful and frightened of Ebola, and they still have a bunker in the middle. They've dug a big, deep bunker where they can hide if people come and shoot at them.
The Foreign Desk with me, Andrew Muller, is available every Saturday from midday London time, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. I am Markus Hippi. We continue with the latest business news with Bloomberg's Euan Potts. Thanks for joining us as always, Euan. We were hearing at the top of the show about the COVID protests in China, and that's something that is proving to be quite a big problem for Apple. How much can you tell us?
Marcus, yes, of course, as well as being a key political story, the protests in China are also a big, big business story. Apple's manufacturing plant, its main iPhone manufacturing plant, is run by a Taiwanese company called Foxconn. The enormous plant, which employs as many as 200,000 workers during peak iPhone production season, is run by the Taiwanese company, and it is facing a deficit of as many as 6 million iPhone Pro units this year. That's an estimate, according to Bloomberg sources. Now, the campus has been racked by lockdowns and worker unrest for weeks. It hasn't just started happening in the recent days. COVID infections left Foxconn and local authorities struggling to contain the outbreak. A lot of protests at the plant. Now, the facility produces the vast majority of the iPhone 14 Pro and Pro Max devices, and those are Apple's most in-demand handsets this year. The company has been looking at diversifying its supply, but they do come out of China at the moment, and that is causing a lot of issues for the company. It's really a stark reminder of the risks of Apple having its vast supply chain in China, and when these kind of restrictions come into place, it causes a lot of problems for the company. The Foxconn has been responding in recent weeks by offering bonuses to workers who are unhappy to leave the plant and return home. It's now, over the last weekend, added a bonus for workers who are going to stay there during January and February, as much as £1,800 a month they're going to be offered to stay at the plant. So the company really trying to make sure that production doesn't fall out of place.
Let's continue with news from London next. Euan, why is UK energy policy proving to be so controversial for Conservative MPs?
So Rishi Sunak, the UK Prime Minister, is facing potentially a second rebellion on the same piece of legislation. He already had to back down on house building after a number of Conservative MPs said they wouldn't back further house building, national targets on house building in the UK. Of course, a very controversial subject amongst Conservative MPs, many of whom represent rural areas where their constituents just don't want more houses built. And now on energy policy, looks like he may have to back down as well. So the controversy is over onshore wind. Now, the UK has a lot of offshore wind, lots of power from offshore wind production. It's actually the second biggest producer of offshore electricity in the world after China. But onshore wind has effectively been banned by the government for a number of years, again, because of opposition to building wind turbines in the countryside. And now more than 20 Conservative MPs, including, interestingly, both Boris Johnson and Liz Truss, Rishi Sunak's two predecessors, have said they want to encourage building new wind farms in the countryside. So this is in contrast to the policies. That means that Sunak may have to back down on this. Remember, Rishi Sunak has a majority of 69 in Parliament. So it means he can only afford to lose the votes of about 35 Conservative MPs before he's in trouble. Labour, the opposition party, backs this particular change. They want to see more wind farms. The problem for the government is that it is useful, it is cheap to provide to produce wind power, it is green and it is cheap, but it is controversial in those countryside areas. So another row for the Prime Minister.
Quite a headache for Rishi Sunak indeed. Ewan, thank you very much for joining us. That was Bloomberg's Ewan Potts, and you're with the briefing. Finally, on today's program, we are going to take a closer look at some of the stories making news at the World Cup in Qatar. I'm joined in the studio by our own Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Hello, Fernando. How are you today?
Very good, Marcos. Besides, of course, the exciting football matches a bit later today, but I decided to select a few stories, I think, about the World Cup that is not necessarily just about football. If I may start, let's talk about the TV ratings for this World Cup. I was very curious about it because there's been a lot of talk about boycotting the event, you know, because of the human rights situation in Qatar, their treatment to LGBTQ populations and the treatment for migrant workers. But the reality is, Marcus, even with all those problems, people still want to watch the matches. There's been record-breaking numbers. Look at the US. Their match against England, which was a little bit of a boring match, I have to add, had the record of the most watched men's football match ever in the country, with 15.3 million viewers of Americans watching this. This is remarkable, remembering that the Americans, you know, they, I think football is becoming more and more important there, but it's not their main sport.
I'm wondering if these ratings reflect how football is indeed getting more popular over there in that country.
Absolutely. I think, you know, especially women's football, that was the case already, but I think we can say, you know, we can say this with confidence that men's football is doing the same as well. But it's not just the USA. I mean, even football mad countries like France and Brazil, they're recording their highest ratings. Look at France. Their latest match was the best rating of the year. And even in Brazil, it's been the highest audience on television since 2006. So, you know, clearly there's still very much a desire. And I wonder if you're going to ask me, are there any countries that are bucking the trend?
There are. Are there any countries bucking the trend for them?
Sorry, I was forcing that question on you. Apparently so. Apparently Germany, the ratings are a little bit down. Mm-hmm. It's not a disaster, but, you know, apparently some people there are boycotting, or perhaps Germany is not doing that well as well.
What's the mood in Brazil now? What is making headlines in your home country?
Well, that's our second story. I think this is interesting because people say that football can heal a nation in a way. I think this is can be an exaggerated statement, but I think it could happen in Brazil. In the first match, a player called Richarlison, he scored two goals, beautiful goals as well. And it's interesting because a lot of Brazilians, they were supportive of the Brazilian national team, but they were a bit embarrassed because some players like Neymar, you know, he voted Bolsonaro and he was very clear about that. And as you know, the country is very divided in political terms, so it became a little bit awkward to support the national football team without thinking that you're also a Bolsonaro supporter. But with Richarlison, it's different. He is a man, he supports several charities. I remember during COVID in Brazil, he was one of the first ones to go on TV and say, please go and vaccinate
vaccinate. He's always supporting anti-racism groups, among else. He didn't declare his vote, but people think he's progressive and they're happy to have someone like him.
Did the Brazilian team at every point have discussions of the kind we saw in the UK, for example, how the whole team wanted to wear those One Love armbands and so forth? Is the Brazilian team, is it the culture over there for the team to make a statement and to stand for good things?
Less so than in the case of England, for example. But I wouldn't say that they don't. They can be a little bit political. There's been quite a big movement in Brazil, an anti-racism movement, anti-homophobia as well, but perhaps not in the same way as you see it in England. But I hope it's changing. I mean, I think some players are feeling a little bit more brave to show their political convictions as well.
Finally, we should talk about obviously what's been making headlines today. What happened in Belgium after the country lost the match against Morocco? A lot of unrest.
Oh, a lot of unrest. So basically, some people were lifting fires in the streets. They were throwing missiles at the police. It's been huge, and the reason for that, apparently, I can't say for sure that that was the only reason, but was the fact that Belgium lost to Morocco. That was quite a bit of a surprise. So there's been a lot of unrest in Belgium for that. That just shows how people feel very passionate, but in a very bad way when it comes to football. But yeah, the scenes in the city center of Brussels, they were frankly quite awful. I think even the mayor said avoid the area if you are a football fan as well.
That's always so confusing, seeing that. Who are those people who want to go and break windows when their country loses a football match? Just finally, Fernando, what are you looking forward to next?
I mean, if you do like football, today's a very good day for it. I think just in about 20-30 minutes from now, South Korea and Ghana will be playing, Brazil and Switzerland as well at 4 p.m. UK time. But I think, I have to say, at 7 p.m. there's a very special match, Portugal and Uruguay. They're two very good, one of the best countries when it comes to football. So that's definitely a match I'll be watching.
A busy day ahead. Thank you very much, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And that's all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Rhys James. Our researcher was Emily Sands and our studio manager was Adam Heaton. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. That's at 20:00 in Beijing, midday here in London, and 7 a.m. in Washington, D.C. I am Markus Hippi. Goodbye and thanks for listening.